loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we're going to discuss and analyze Donald Trump's immigration plan with experts, people representing immigrant workers both on the East and West Coast. Is Trump's plan designed as a poison pill to destroy any possibility for immigration reform? Does this plan have any chance to succeed? We're going to talk about all of that. And then in our second hour, we're going to talk about prop or not. More than a year ago, the Washington Post ran a story using something called prop or not as its sole source. Prop or not purported to identify Russian propaganda outlets in the United States media, and it accused some of the best known and most important news sites in the progressive community of being Russian stooges. We're going to look at an article talking about who prop or not really is and what their agenda might be.
And in our second hour, we talk about the five big stories of the day. First, the House Intelligence Committee is voting as we speak on whether or not to release the so-called Nunes memo, which will likely allege an FBI conspiracy to take down the Trump presidency. Is it based on intelligence or on Republican fantasies? Meanwhile, FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe resigned today prior to his scheduled March departure. Next, the Afghan capital of Kabul has been racked by an unusually high level of violence over the past week, with attacks coming from both the Taliban and ISIS. More than 125 people have been killed. Then, Robert Perry, the legendary journalist and founder of Consortium News, has died at 68. Bob was a longtime reporter for the Associated Press and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for uncovering the production of a CIA assassination manual for Central American rebels. And then, U.S. authorities today are set to arrest several people implicated in connection with a federal investigation into something called spoofing and manipulation of the U.S. futures markets by three European banks. And finally, if you thought the war in Yemen couldn't get any more complicated, you're wrong. Separatists allied with the United Arab Emirates are fighting troops allied with Saudi Arabia for control of the southern part of Yemen. Some observers are now predicting the secession of southern Yemen. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we take a look at Donald Trump's immigration proposal. We're joined from Baltimore by Heather Benno. She's the managing attorney at Esperanza Center, an immigrant rights organization. And we're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. And we're going to be talking in this half hour about Donald Trump's so-called immigration plan, what it means, whether it's likely to succeed or not in Congress. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me again, Brian.
Let me just summarize real quickly for the audience the essence of the Trump plan. In exchange for giving a path towards legalization and possible citizenship for not only the 800,000 to 1 million people who are called the Dreamers, people who came to the United States as young children without documents, but another 800,000 or so people sort of in the same age category or in the same bracket, we can talk about what that means. In exchange, Trump's plan would dramatically overhaul the existing legal immigration system. Immigrants would only be allowed to sponsor their spouses and underage children to join them in the United States, and not their parents, not adult children, or not siblings. The Trump administration said it would only end new applications for visas, allowing those already in the pipeline to be processed. Anyway, Juan Jose, it's a bargain that maybe I don't know what the immigrant rights community feels about this. What's your take?
Well, the immigrant rights community feels that President Donald Trump is being disingenuous if he thinks that this is an acceptable quid pro quo, that the community is willing to take from his administration. The fact is that as you describe what the main component parts of the proposal on the table that his administration has made to leading Democrats in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, constitute nothing more than a whole host of unacceptable poison pills that make his proposal, as it exists presently, completely unacceptable, not just to the immigrant rights community, but to the activists based in the Democratic Party, to say nothing of the of progressives that do not necessarily work within the ranks of the Democratic Party. So, this is a very bad proposal that the president has made to the immigrant community, and I don't see any sector within progressive immigration politics who believes, that we should trade, accepting all these bad component parts of the immigration proposal that he's making in exchange for essentially, getting some kind of deal to fix the problem of the Dreamers.
Let's get Heather Benno. Heather is an attorney in Baltimore. She is the managing attorney at Esperanza Center, an immigrant rights organization. Heather, of course, Juan Jose is registering the opinion of at least a significant part of the immigrant rights community. But of course, in Congress, the immigrant rights community isn't there. They don't have a vote. Trump is trying to let's analyze what Trump is actually trying to do. He's saying to the Democrats, give me things that will end the existing immigration system for the so-called merit-based system. It's a real crackdown both on legal and so-called illegal, that is, immigration for people without documents. Are the Democrats going to appreciate this? Are they going to support it? Are they going to feel the pressure from the immigrant rights community? And also, it seems to me that as bad as this plan might be, big parts of the Republican conservative movement are opposed to it because it gives any kind of relief for the Dreamers. Matter of fact, Breitbart was calling, front page headline was Amnesty Don attacking Trump as a pro-immigrant rights president. Anyway, Heather Benno, go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of ironic, right? Considering the fact that the proposal would be to eliminate basically three out of the five legal avenues that you listed earlier. I don't remember whether you had listed elimination of the diversity lottery program, but
I did not. But talk about that real quick, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, that comes from legislation that reflects the general consensus that the United States does benefit from immigration, lawful immigration specifically, and that there are people from all over the world who couldn't otherwise qualify for visas to come to this country, but who may, be excellent contributing members of society here, and that this country actually wants to recruit people from various countries, underrepresented countries, people in Africa, in Asia, and some European countries as well, to come to the United States under limited and essentially a limited lottery program. All studies show that when immigrants come to a community, that community benefits. The economic figures go up. Quality of life goes up in terms of more cultural events. New businesses open in the area, giving neighborhoods more vibrancy. So that was the policy behind the diversity lottery program. And I think kind of in line with what Mr. Gutierrez was describing earlier, the elimination of this is just another essentially racist attack on immigrants coming from those countries. And even if the administration were to try to, as a compromise, try to slash the program just to eliminate immigration from Africa, that proposal would also be subject to lawsuits, similar to the TPS termination from Haiti, because it will be motivated by racism, clearly.
You know, I was happy to see at least a tweet from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who said that the president's plan was nothing more than a wish list for that anti-immigration hardliners have been advocating for years. And so that tells me that Trump's plan, as we see it now, doesn't have a prayer of getting through the U.S. Senate. Would you agree, Juan Jose?
Well, look, I think it's more than a wish list. I mentioned the word poison pills, which is what his proposal really represents in each one of the categories that have been mentioned this morning. But let's take one of them, offering a path to citizenship to Dreamers. You know, this is supposed to constitute a cornerstone of the seriousness of this latest proposal by the Trump administration to immigrants. But, you know, this is a form, in reality, of a form fake path to citizenship, because providing Dreamers, you know, that kind of path, you know, 12 or so, years after they obtain legal permanent residency, you know, is unacceptable, because under current immigration law, it only takes 5 years after you become a legal resident, you know, to get your citizenship, and only 3 years if your spouse is a citizen. So even to the target community that the Trump administration is sending this proposal to, which are the Dreamers, the people that were brought as children to the United States by their parents, is really unacceptable, because under current law, immigrants have a better chance of finding a path to permanent legalization and eventual citizenship. So I think, you know, that what Attorney Benno mentioned right now about, you know, what is lottery migration and what's the idea behind it, you know, which is to make sure that we continue to have immigration diversity, which is very beneficial to the United States on the whole, you know, are the clearest indications that the people that advise the president on immigration issues are bent on doing everything they can to sabotage any resolution of this issue, even on a limited scale, and they're doing everything to make sure that that happens.
Yeah, the actual roots, Heather, I believe, of the diversity lottery had more to do with the Irish and Italian immigrants who
That's
felt
right.
They were getting a raw deal. But I think what Trump is doing, and I think both of you have commented on this, and I saw an interesting piece in one of the, I think it was the New York Times over the weekend, where a congressperson who is in a almost all white area was talking about how his constituents absolutely didn't want to give any relief to the Dreamers, because they were presenting it and he's presenting it. And this is, I think, you know, sort of catalyzed to some degree by Trump and earlier anti-immigrant hysteria, of course. This is like the last chance to save America, which only means really to keep America white. And so what they're really thinking, whether they use the word diversity or not, they're really thinking about Latinos. They're thinking about Africans. They're thinking about people from the Caribbean. And as a consequence, what we really see is using, you know, the KKK in the 1920s, they had a medallion that said, make America great, or America first. And then it said, then it was about racial purity. It's a medallion. It was very popular in the 1920s. It seems to me that we have ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, now functioning as the enforcement mechanism and the sort of the ideological channel for what used to be the KKK in 1920, 100 years ago. Again, this is about white supremacy and racism, bottom line. Go ahead, Heather.
Yeah, so just to follow up on that, you're right. The diversity visa program came from the struggle of Irish and Italian immigrants to the U.S. fighting against what essentially was a racist immigration system. And the purpose was to open immigration to a diverse country, a diverse array of countries. So it's not just killing the diversity visa program or diversity lottery program that would be done basically only based on racism, but also the slashing of the family-based immigration options. The proposal, Trump's proposal, according to the Migration Policy Institute, would decrease lawful access to permanent residency by 36%, by approximately 36%. that would mean that 36% less applications for permanent residency could be processed in the United States or even at all, due to the fact that the relationship is would no longer be a basis for status. So clearly, who is this targeting? This is targeting families that seek to reunify in the United States. And again, we see the grand majority of the people who really need to be, who are experiencing long-term family separation, are immigrants from Latin American countries, Mexico, and currently Central America, areas that are experiencing a high rate of violence currently, as well as African countries where people have been separated for many, many years, awaiting their visa to become available.
And I wonder how many families from places like Iraq or Afghanistan are going to be affected. Families that have worked for the U.S. military, let's say, as translators, and now it's just unsafe for them to remain in their own countries. And so because of these changes or these proposed changes, there are family members who would be at risk of death, at risk of violence, just because they would no longer be allowed to even apply for status in the United States.
Yeah, it's all based fundamentally on racism. I'm looking, Juan Jose, I want to pick up where Heather left off. I'm looking at a memo. It's a graphic that the White House developed, and they sent it around. And the big headline is, as a result of chain immigration, white lettering on a black background, every hour the U.S. permanently resettles enough migrants on the basis of family ties to fill a small auditorium. Every day, the U.S. resettles enough migrants on the basis of family ties to fill a large high school. Every week, the U.S. resettles enough migrants on the basis of family ties to fill a college basketball arena. Every month, the U.S. resettles more migrants on the basis of family ties than can fill an entire football stadium to capacity, which is like not that many.
Crazy.
Given the fact that it's a country of 310 million. But these breathless headlines in the White House, it's actually whitehouse.gov is producing its own memes.
Yes.
To go to the public with these alarmist concepts that chain migration is filling football stadiums worth of people.
Yes, with the idea being that this is automatically a bad thing. It's a very hate-filled position.
Yeah, so who are those people? They're the parents of people who are here legally.
Yeah.
They're filling football stadiums. Anyway, disgusting. Juan Jose, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's a whole ideology that's driving this change in immigration policy, right? That aims primarily to stop people that are not white from being able to legalize permanently and lawfully to the U.S. We mentioned, what chain migration means, lottery migration, et cetera. But the wall, too. I mean, the wall has already antagonized and was meant to antagonize all immigrants, by telling them, in very no uncertain terms, that they're no longer welcome in the U.S. unless they are white and educated and on and on and on. So, yes, I would agree with you, Brian, that and everybody in this program that, what Donald Trump is doing in making these proposals and insisting on them as a way to solve the Dreamer problem are nothing more than gimmicks designed to prevent any kind of acceptable resolution, to the nightmare that these young Dreamers are suffering as a result of the racist policies of the Donald Trump administration.
So is it a poison pill, Heather? I mean, has Trump's not just a, quote, wish list, but poison pills such that he can say, well, I offered relief to the Dreamers and 800,000 more younger immigrants, but we have to have a $25 billion wall. We have to end the existing immigration system that allows people to bring their parents or children, certain categories of children. In other words, designed really to break up families. Is it done in this way so that the Democrats ultimately, if they vote no, or a combination of Democrats and conservative Republicans who won't tolerate any relief for the Dreamers, they vote no, and Donald Trump can say, well, I tried, I gave it a shot. Is that what we're witnessing, or do you think that this actually has a chance of passing?
Well, it seems that a bipartisan group again has come out today against the proposal. It's, of course, nobody has a crystal ball. It doesn't seem likely that this proposal as is, even though it was presented by the White House as a take it or leave it type of thing, is going to actually move forward because it's intentionally constructed to be a poison pill. But that said, I do want to think back just to the late 80s when there was another compromise on immigration, to say that it's not new to try to essentially sell out one immigrant community or one group of immigrants in exchange for protections for others. And that's what did happen under the legalization program, where there was intense investment in quote-unquote enforcement or border security in exchange for legalization at that time. Here, because of the breadth of this proposal, because family-based immigration in the current period where this administration has restricted refugee admittance to historic lows, family-based immigration remains the primary way that people are able to come to the United States. So in comparison to all other, you know, developed countries, family-based immigration in the United States has actually a higher percentage of immigrants who come based on family-based immigration than on other types. And that doesn't actually speak in favor of our system. It just means that our system is so slow and provides so few humanitarian and employment-based options already that most people are stuck waiting for decades to be able to immigrate based on family membership, and that's all they have available to them. So because of the centrality of family-based immigration to immigrants from all countries in the United States, I think that it would be incredibly difficult for the Democrats to sideline that and to move forward despite what their constituencies so clearly oppose about this proposal.
Juan Jose Gutierrez, they're talking about a family-based immigration system with different words. They call it chain migration. That sounds sort of sinister and dangerous, but it's really about families. It's about allowing families to stay together. If you I want you to take an attack at the same question that we're asking Heather, and because it's the big issue right now, could you conceive of the Democrats going ahead with the end of the existing family-based immigration system in exchange for giving relief to the Dreamers? And then if you would, because I know you were very deeply involved in the immigration after the immigration law that was passed in the late 1980s, I think 1986, that Heather mentioned, what was originally called the Simpson-Mazzoli Act, which the Republicans and others now deride as the amnesty of the Reagan era. But, you know, millions of people were able to gain a pathway to legal citizenship. There were, of course, border security and other measures that were considered negative. But in general, looking back, that was considered to be, or certainly is considered now to be, something that was a very big step forward. And you, I know, helped people in Southern California try to take advantage of those opportunities to take a pathway to citizenship. So compare the two eras, if you would.
Well, I think that the bill that became law and that made it possible to have approximately 3 million immigrants, give or take a few, to become permanent legal residents in the United States. Looking at it from the vantage point of where we are now, was a very progressive immigration bill in that it did not eliminate family reunification, and of course allowed many undocumented workers, I would say the majority of the undocumented workers and their families who were then residing in the United States, you know, to enter a path to permanent legal residency and eventual legalization. And there was a component part of this bill which was known as SAW, seasonal agricultural workers, who were given all sorts of opportunities to become permanent legal residents in the U.S. I mean, you only had to prove back then that you work at least 90 days in agriculture, and that entitled you, you know, to petition to become a permanent legal resident in the U.S. Compare that to what's being proposed in this, you know, proposal from the Donald Trump administration. I mean, to begin with, you know, as compared to 1986, you know, that bill was, you know, very comprehensive. This doesn't even begin to approach being comprehensive. I mean, it's only it all started with people in Congress and the Dreamer community themselves demanding that there be a resolution of their legal plight. You know, given the program being ended effectively September 5th by the Donald Trump administration, right? And so, I mean, there's clearly no comparison between what we're doing now and what happened back in the 1980s. You know, I think that the country became better because of the immigration bill of the 1980s and all the people that were, you know, that managed to apply for and receive legal residency. Many of them are now U.S. citizens, and I don't think that anybody would argue, unless you're a, you know, a big racist, you know, that you know, made the United States a worse place, you know, than what it became as a result of that policy. So, I mean, we're not even talking about anything that remotely, I mean, today we're not talking about anything that remotely compares to what happened in 1986 when IRCA was finally approved by Congress and signed by President Ronald Reagan. So, I mean, I hope that the Democrats, you know, will not cave in and in exchange for getting something, end up giving, some people say, the entire House away. I mean, in my mind at least, it's not inconceivable that that is a danger that could happen, because remember, Senator Schumer, one of his main goals is to, you know, regain control of the Senate. And, you know, they do all these strange political calculations that the way they read the mood of the American voter is such that if they get any sense that they're going to look okay with certain segments of the American electorate, they're certainly more, you know, could be willing to take that as an indicator that, you know, if they cave in an immigration debate right now, you know, that they might win back, you know, the Americans, you know, the U.S. Senate, and that's a practical thing to do from a political stand of view.
We're talking about Donald Trump's immigration proposals. We're joined by Heather Benno. She's the managing attorney at Esperanza Center, an immigrant rights organization, and also by Juan Jose Gutierrez, who's the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Heather, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on the Republican politics of this this plan. I'm looking at the New York Times. It says here the opposition was shared. This is the opposition to the idea, the Trump idea. The opposition was shared by some on the right, including conservative figure Richard Viguerie, who labeled the White House proposal the Trump amnesty disaster in an email, probably a fundraising email.
Right.
Roy Beck, the president of Numbers USA, which seeks to limit legal immigration, called it a framework for a mass amnesty. Do you think that these guys are just trying to provide Trump some political cover on the right? Or do you think that Donald Trump is really under pressure from the right wing of his party, the far right wing of his party, to keep as many immigrants out of this country as possible? We have just under 2 minutes left.
So I guess the question is, how could this even be logically seen as an amnesty when the proposal is really to slash lawful immigration and provide a very limited benefit, even a lesser benefit than what's been available in the past, to a relatively limited number of people. Yeah, it's hard to say whether it's coming because the far right actually have a leg to stand on with this administration, and hence want to just basically oppose anything that would include any relief at all for DACA recipients, or whether this is kind of Donald Trump's cover to say, hey, you know, I'm doing something, I'm trying to take a compromising position here, that I'm not far to the right, and having somebody further to the right makes that sound reasonable. Yeah, it's to me, it's clear that the Trump proposal is not a compromise. As Juan Jose mentioned, while there was some enforcement funds put aside in that actual legalization plan, this looks nothing like that legalization plan. It's not, in fact, a broader way to provide a remedy to most people living in the U.S. And, in fact, it seems like the only reason why DACA is in it is to basically provide a hook to the Democrats such that if they reject the proposal, the Trump administration or the Republican Party can then point to the Democrats and say, oh, the Democrats are the reason why DACA recipients are being deported. At the end of the day, this is really just kind of a game between the two parties. That's the way that they see it. They're not seeing the effect that it has on the millions of people, I believe over a million people who have not been able to register for DACA, but who otherwise would have been eligible under the program because Trump stopped the program in early September. So, yeah, it really does seem like this is a cover just to be able to say, you know, for political reasons that the Trump administration or that this proposal was reasonable. But hopefully we can all agree that it's not reasonable and it shouldn't receive any traction because it doesn't reflect what people in this country, immigrants and non-immigrants alike, have been demanding, at least for the last 10 years.
We're going to leave it right there. That was Heather Benno. She is the managing attorney at Esperanza Center, an immigrant rights organization in Baltimore, Maryland. And we've been joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
A little more than 1 year ago, the Washington Post ran a story using something called Prop or Not as its sole source. Prop or Not purported to identify Russian propaganda outlets in the U.S. media, and it accused some of the best-known and most important news sites in the progressive community of being Russian stooges or vehicles for Russian propaganda. Although they were called experts by the Washington Post, these experts insisted on anonymity, and they still do even today. We look at a new article about who's behind Prop or Not and what their agenda is. Prop or Not says in a tweet that the story is inaccurate and asserts, and I quote, "The author and his fellow travelers have no idea of who we actually are. Interestingly, they retain their anonymity, but insist, while remaining hidden, that they can identify scores of websites, including some of the most well-known progressive sites, as tools of Russia propaganda." We're joined in the studio by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and political commentator and the author of the book, How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we are joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome, Joe and Walter.
Thank you, Brian.
Glad to be here.
Joe Loria, this is a new article out that exposes or starts to expose the mysterious voice of Prop or Not, which, as we know, the Washington Post ran it, made a big story about it. And Prop or Not has developed a list of media that we're not supposed to read because their sources are they're allegedly like a tool of Russian propaganda. Talk about what the new news is on this.
Well, a man called George Eliason wrote a piece for, I think, Washington Blog originally. It was then reprinted in the late Bob Perry's Consortium News, where I read it. And he looks at metadata, which I am in no way an expert on. Maybe John can help us there. So I can't evaluate, you know, his evaluation of the metadata, but what he seems to be seeing there, and he reprints it, is that the Proper Knot organization, the secretive organization, was linked to the Interpreter magazine, maybe belonging to Interpreter magazine, the editor-in-chief of which is Michael Weiss, the CNN commentator and I believe editor of Daily Beast, a known anti-Russian ideologue. And I think he may be proving what a lot of people suspected at the beginning anyway, that this was linked not only to people like that, but to Ukrainian intelligence. He seems to show links about that as well. So if this is true, it's major information to know who's behind this to what fulfill what I think a lot of people suspected. But the whole Proper Knot thing was so extraordinarily bad. And unfortunately, that was really the first salvo and it's become now a whole crescendo of attacks on alternative media and Russian English language media, which in my view is to crush any kind of dissenting opinion that is outside the realm of corporate media, which apparently is all they want us to have. And it seeps out. You know, corporate media has done a good job. And I worked in it for many years for the Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, and I know that a certain side of the story is never told or suppressed, particularly international stories. If a country is considered an enemy of the U.S. or an adversary, you don't get their point of view, which dehumanizes the people there, makes it easier perhaps to go to war against them. But now you have Russian media and dissenting websites like Consortium News, like Washington Blog, like Counterpunch, etc., that have gotten an audience and challenging the establishment narrative. So if it starts seeping out elsewhere, it has to be stopped, and Russia and media is an important source that they want to stop. So, and particularly Ukrainians and anti-Russian crazies in the U.S. Proper Knot, and the Washington Post is completely guilty of publishing an article with an anonymous accuser. I mean, in our system, at least in the legal system, you have a right to know your accuser. And that should extend to the press as well. To have put that on the front page, I believe on Thanksgiving Day a couple of years ago, was extraordinary. But we've seen now, and there could be links, by the way, to the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council has ties to NATO. And we sort of, just to give one more of many of these examples, now NATO last year did this hit piece against Global Research .ca in Canada, which is basically a clearinghouse for alternative news. And many of my stories from Concerned News were reprinted there, and others, and some stories I don't agree with that they published. But this is seen as a threat to the free world by NATO. And they did this report that the Globe and Mail picked up and absolutely crushed, smeared Global Research in the same vein as Proper Knot. And then we also saw this group European Values a few months ago. Whereas Proper Knot only named publications, not individuals, about 200 of them, at least 12 or so that I've written for, as somehow Russian propaganda sites. This European Values report, again, with ties to the Atlantic Council, wrote a ridiculous report with naming 2,000 individuals who were useful idiots for the Kremlin, amongst them being Secretary General Antonio Guterres of the United Nations. And his name is escaping me now. The columnist of the Washington Post is very close to the CIA.
David Ignatius.
Yeah, Ignatius was named as a Kremlin idiot because he had been interviewed. But it just shows the absurdity of it when they started naming names.
Walter Smolarek, jump in if you would. I mean, this piece became very big in the Washington Post. I think it was in December 2016. And it was kind of breathlessly reported again that now we're going to know who the stooges were of Russian propaganda. And again, it was completely anonymous. We didn't know who a prop or not was, but it was treated with good coin. Glenn Greenwald and Ben Norton wrote an important article. People can see it. It was in November 2016 in The Intercept. I'm going to read a couple words to you and then have you comment and then talk about this news story and what we're learning here. The Washington Post, this is from Glenn Greenwald and Ben Norton. The Washington Post on Thursday night promoted the claims of a new shadowy organization that smears dozens of U.S. news sites that are critical of U.S. foreign policy as being, quote, routine peddlers of Russian propaganda, close quote. The article reported by Craig Timberg headlined, Russian propaganda effort helps spread fake news during the election, comma, experts say, close quote. Cites a report by an anonymous website calling itself Prop or Not, meaning propaganda or not, which claims that millions of Americans have been deceived this year in a massive Russia misinformation campaign. The group's list of Russian disinformation outlets include WikiLeaks, the Drudge Report, as well as Clinton-critical left-wing websites such as Truthout, Black Agenda Report, Truthdig, and Naked Capitalism, as well as libertarian venues such as antiwar.com and the Ron Paul Institute. If you look at the list, Walter, it's a long list. Talk about what that meant back in December or November 2016 and what the new news shows about who these folks actually are, prop or not.
Yeah, I think that the results of the 2016 election threw the establishment into a bit of a panic. You know, it's not that Donald Trump is some sort of like great champion of the people or some progressive, you know, like he has none of
putting it mildly.
Yeah. But he was clearly not the favored choice, right? Not because, you know, he was going to do anything good, but because he was seen as a less reliable, far less reliable manager of the system than Hillary Clinton. And so elements of sort of like the permanent professional apparatus of the government went into motion to try to constrain the foreign policy decisions that the Trump administration could realistically pursue. And so one of these was this like fake news phenomenon. So there's this extensive Russian propaganda effort in the United States, the story goes, and it has its tentacles in all of these different websites, which some of which are, you know, like have been around for many, many, many years, well-regarded progressive news sites. So the Atlantic Council, so the person who, Michael Weiss, he's the editor of the Interpreter magazine. The Interpreter magazine is a project of the Atlantic Council, and the Atlantic Council, which has very deep relations to, of course, the NATO organization, like Joe was saying, but also to things like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is run by the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is
the U.S. government. That's the U.S.
It's the U.S. government's propaganda outlet.
Exactly.
Radio Marti,
Voice of America, Radio TV Marti.
So break it down. Bring that chain out, if you would, Walter.
Yeah, sure. So the Interpreter is the magazine that this journalist linked to Prop or Not, right? Saying, well, the person who runs Prop or Not, or, you know, Prop or Not is basically a product of the Interpreter magazine. The Interpreter magazine is a product of the Atlantic Council. And the Atlantic Council, through, you know, just the universe of the relatively small universe of quote unquote national security experts in Washington, is related to, and I believe receives funding from, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is an official U.S. government agency and quite an important one at that.
A propaganda outlet.
That's exactly what it's been set up to do, is to promote American propaganda overseas.
And by the way, it's illegal for the BBG to propagandize Americans in America.
Correct. In fact, the BBG had to get a congressional waiver in order to broadcast radio and TV Marti from a plane that they fly back and forth just off the coast of Cuba, because American citizens can still receive the signal in South Florida.
And people don't know, there's another side to this. This is just a little tangent, but it's interesting for people. During the trial of the Cuban Five in Miami, the reporters who were writing the most bombastic anti-Cuban Five stories and anti-Cuba stories were also on the payroll of Radio Marti and Voice of Marti. They were getting salaried employees, and Radio Marti and TV Marti were agencies of the BBG, the Broadcast Board of Governors, a U.S. propaganda outlet. So even though it's against the law for the American government to officially propagandize to Americans through these agencies, they were hiring journalists, Miami Herald journalists and other journalists in Miami, as independent contractors doing the same thing. So during maybe at the nighttime shift, they were doing Radio Marti, daytime shift doing Miami Herald, but writing stories that actually tampered with, I would say, the jury pool in the case of the Cuban Five, because it was creating so much hatred. In other words, there's a lot here, a lot about this story. If the Atlantic Council is getting support from the BBG, and they're the force behind the Interpreter magazine, and the editor of the Interpreter is really the force behind Proper Not, and Proper Not is treated as an anonymous but good source by the Washington Post, and then identifying all of these organizations that you mentioned, Joe, some of which you write for, as Russia propaganda outlets, in other words, organizations that shouldn't be trusted, this is nothing other than a return to the 1950s style witch hunt. Go ahead, Joe.
I want to ask Joe, in addition to that, why is it that Proper Not worked so hard to remain anonymous?
That's a very good question. What are they afraid of?
Yeah, exactly.
They're championing the American way. They're protecting the people. So they should be out in front about that because of what we're discussing right here. The links that Brian just very eloquently put together. They didn't want to show these links, Atlantic Council, to BBG, to the U.S. government, to the State Department, who has some had some role, at least on Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, et cetera. I do want to correct one thing that Brian said, which was that it's illegal to propagandize the U.S. population with these Radio Free Europe, et cetera, but it's not anymore. The story is right here from Foreign Policy, July 2013. It was repealed. The propaganda ban, and it was under the Obama administration. They have repealed that. It went into effect July 2, 2013. So you can broadcast Voice of America type broadcasting inside the U.S. now.
Walter Smolarek, Jill Loria mentioned at the beginning of this discussion the fact that that the author, George Eliason, was able to use metadata in order to identify the origin of Proper Not. And I'm looking here at a chart in his article. It's fascinating. It's actually not terribly difficult to find metadata in an email, in an article, anything that appears over the internet. There are commercial companies that will do it for you for $35, $36 a year. ReadNotify.com is one. It looks like he used exactly the same kind of technology that ReadNotify uses. And in a matter of really minutes, he was able to figure out that Proper Not originates with Interpreter magazine and with Michael Weiss. So Michael Weiss is actually a player in this space, right? If you don't know the name, you've undoubtedly seen him on TV. He's the editor-in-chief at Interpreter magazine. He's a national security analyst for CNN. He's an investigative reporter for international affairs for CNN. He's the senior editor at the Daily Beast. The guy really is a player. So why, if he's so certain about his information, why would he not go public in a big way on CNN or in the Daily Beast? Why would he hide behind this Proper Not?
Yeah, and if you go to the Proper Not website, which I'm not encouraging unless you want to have a laugh or something, it's just so pathetically like structured in design. You know, it looks like something that like a high school student did as their, final project for the year. Why, like, they clearly wanted to look like, you know, crusading citizens who just sort of set this up out of like their feelings of patriotic duty to expose the great Russian menace facing the United States. And in fact, I think in one of their who are we pages on the website, they talk about, you know, funding, what funding or something like that. You know, I think they kind of wanted to cultivate this image of just like, you know, people who, you know, might not be professionals, but they're just so moved by this great threat that our country is facing. And it just really shows the absolute, you know, the Washington Post and all these other mainstream media outlets that picked up this story and reported it as true. The fact that they didn't do just like the most basic amount of homework, or even, you know, even if this is like technically complicated to do, I mean, these outlets are certainly well resourced enough to do the same type of research. So it's I think, an indictment not just of the people, Weiss and others, who this report is saying is behind Proper Not, but really the entire corporate media apparatus, who just goes along without the slightest bit of journalistic integrity with stories that fit the overall storyline that they're trying to push.
I think that they may have wanted to stay anonymous for two reasons. One, because they knew it was a bunch of bull that they were pushing, and they wouldn't want to have to defend themselves and answer questions and prove it. And number two, perhaps lawsuits, legal action against them. I think Eliason mentions the possibility of lawsuits against them. Washington Post.
Yes.
That building's not very far from here. They should be maybe being served by somebody. for publishing that.
I think you're right. And Joe, like you, I've written for at least a half a dozen of these so-called Russian propaganda mouthpieces that Propernot is accusing. And they're really just, to me, mainstream progressive news sites. This is where I go to get my news. And these are the guys who, you know, put food on my table.
I know that later in the show, you're going to be speaking about Bob Perry. And to have his site, Consortium News there, which I've been writing, have been writing for 6 years, to name him as a Russian propagandist, as many do, it is to know that he was just doing what I think Bob's was trying to do is just do his job as a reporter. And that became increasingly different at AP and Newsweek. And then he started his own site and he continued to do his own job where most corporate reporters are not doing that job anymore of telling all sides of a story, of questioning government statements, and particularly from intelligence agencies, not just to believe them. He kept the skepticism from the 1970s Church Committee, which the press then had. That was the old Washington Post, New York Times. Reporters today working for them are living off that reputation. That's not the same newspaper anymore, or both of them.
Right.
And Bob kept that going. And to have his name on that list is just...
And another one is Bob Scheer. Former top journalist at the Los Angeles Times.
Absolutely.
And the proprietor now of Truthdig, which is another terrific progressive news site.
No, it's a Russian propaganda outlet. Just go to Propernot. You'll learn the truth, John Kiriakou. Let's talk about the Atlantic Council, because we're here in Washington, D.C. We are on K Street. All around us for a few blocks is these think tanks.
We're surrounded.
And if you go to the State Department list of events coming up this week, you'll see Brookings Institute or Rand Corporation or the American Enterprise Institute or the Heritage Foundation or the Atlantic Council. You know, they're all in the mix. They're part of this tight network of so-called intellectuals who provide the talking points, in essence, for U.S. policy. And the Atlantic Council provides the talking points and the rationale and some of the resources to bring together the so-called sort of staple of intelligentsia, loosely used term, who are justifying or defending or promoting neocon, that is, aggressive interventionist policies around the world. Now, the Atlantic Council, so again, Atlantic Council is connected to the interpreter is connected to prop or not. In February 2009, James L. Jones was the chairman of the Atlantic Council. He stepped down to take what position? Can we remember? No, of course not, because at the time we would have remembered. He became President Obama's new national security advisor. So he went right from the Atlantic Council to be the national security advisor, meaning the top leader in the White House of the National Security Council, the president's advisory panel. In addition, other council members, the Atlantic Council, also left to serve the Obama administration. This was in 2009. They included Susan Rice. She was Atlantic Council. She became ambassador to the United Nations. Who else? Richard Holbrooke. He was the special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan. General Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Anne Marie Slaughter, Director of Policy Planning at the State Department. I mean, these were the chief people within the Obama administration foreign policy team.
Yes.
They went from the Atlantic Council. It's a revolving door.
It is.
They went from the Atlantic Council directly into the national security apparatus of the Obama administration. They circle out of it as the Obama administration's coming to an end. Of course, the Trump election was not foreseen by anyone. It was considered an unmitigated disaster by those within this neocon environment. And again, we're not Trump supporters. Far from it. We're opponents of Donald Trump. But just saying, that's the truth. They didn't want Donald Trump. And Donald Trump's big sin was not his xenophobia, not his misogyny, not his racism. It was because he said he wanted better relations with Russia, which, of course, Obama said when he became president. I mean, Hillary Clinton went to Lavrov with that big red reset button.
Right.
It was, by the way, it was translated poorly.
Yes.
It said overload instead of reset, so it's a little bit confusing. That aside, but even before that, George W. Bush said he wanted better relations with Russia. Remember, he looked directly into the eyes of Vladimir Putin and
saw his soul.
He saw his soul.
Right.
But nowadays, under these circumstances, wanting better relations with Russia, post-Ukraine, post-coup d'etat in 2014, that becomes something that's really opposing the Washington consensus right now. So they were unhappy with Trump coming in. They were worried. So you have the Atlantic Council and other people like them, I think, concocting the so-called Russiagate sort of hysteria, meaning if you wanted better relations with Russia, that meant you must be a stooge of Russia. And that's, in essence, how this has played out. And again, how discredited could the should the Washington Post be for using prop or not, up until now, an anonymous source to tell us who to look at, who to read, because some organizations, if they are critical of U.S. foreign policy, are stooges of Russia.
Well, we look at the editorial board of the Washington Post and what they wrote in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, for example. They've been big-time neocons, and there's no accountability. They say outrageous things that are proven false, and they carry on in their high-paying and very influential jobs. So it fit perfectly, prop or not, in my opinion. Into the pages, the front page of the Washington Post.
That's what the Post has become.
Yeah, back in the day, back in the 1940s and 50s, Walter, people were hauled before the House of Un-American Activities Committee, and they were asked, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Then they said whatever, either they took the fifth or they said no. Then they say, well, did you sign this petition, a petition for peace? Did you sign something against nuclear weapons, something that the Communist Party or the World Peace Council may have been involved with? And thus that became, by virtue of guilt by association, you are tarnished. And so in a way, everything that was associated with anything related to the Soviet Union or then peace became something that became almost a criminal enterprise. It seems to me that that's where we are right now.
Right. And even if you weren't targeted by that, it had a chilling effect on all other activism. Like, even if you hadn't signed, a petition against nuclear weapons, for instance, because of the atmosphere of McCarthyism, people wouldn't then go on to sign, petitions against nuclear weapons or speak out against war or whatever, because they knew that there would be such a serious, such potentially serious consequences for their careers, for their families. They could even be potentially imprisoned if they were, targeted intensely enough. So this is, I think, an extremely dangerous thing. I mean, it's so silly and baseless that it's easy to sort of ridicule and poke fun at. And I think that's important. But it should also be taken extremely seriously.
That's all the time we have. We've been joined by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and political commentator and author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we've been joined also in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek.